campus 103.7 u Departiment tal-Istudji Politiċi u l-Governanza jistennuk għal PhD Unpacked, il-programm fejn nitkellmu dwar l-esperjenzi ta' studenti li qed jagħmlu PhD. Immexxi d-diskussjoni jiena, Dr. Mirna Azzopardi Wood. Welcome to PhD Unpacked, the series where we dig deep into the personal journeys, challenges, and turning points that make up the world of doctoral research. In this episode, we're going to be focusing on a theme that often comes up behind the scenes of the PhD experience, work-life balance. What happens when your research is intense and the whole process seems overwhelming? How do you carve out time for yourself? On the show with me today, I have Jenny Orlando-Salling, whose PhD is about legal history and constitutional law. Jenny is doing her PhD with the University of Copenhagen. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about your research?
My research started out in a bit of a convoluted way, actually. I was signed on to the University of Copenhagen as part of a European Research Council project to do a study on basically the legacies of the Austro-Hungarian Empire on EU law. But throughout the time that I was, basically, especially the first few months, I kept on being asked to write about Malta. And I signed up for a conference that was taking place in Oslo, I believe it was 2022. And I basically got stuck in to Maltese research, research on Maltese legal history and specifically constitutional law. And that led me to the research that I've been undertaking for the last basically 2.5 years, I think now, and to my PhD thesis, which I should be submitting later this month or earlier next month. We're speaking in August 2025, so I'm just reminding myself. But my research is basically about constitutionalism and coloniality in the European legal order, and it tries to bring a Maltese perspective into European constitutional law, looking specifically at the heritage of British colonialism on Maltese constitutional law.
It's very, very interesting. It's not the topic that you would usually have, you know, with your morning coffee and eggs, but it is a very, very worthy topic. But let's move a little bit into the chosen theme of today's episode. Jenny, I know you're a mother. I know you have a lot of responsibilities outside of the PhD. Naturally, you work as well. How did you approach work-life balance throughout your PhD? I'd like to hear your perspective.
I think, first of all, I was just really fortunate to be studying in an environment and also in a country that really forces you effectively to balance work with obligations outside of work and especially with family. I was very fortunate, I think, in Copenhagen to also have colleagues who were constantly pushing me to rest and to go home when I had long days at the office. So that really, really helped. But I very much from the very beginning, having come at the time from diplomacy, realized that I needed to do things differently, especially at the time when I started my PhD. I was also doing a master's degree at the same time and lecturing at the University of Copenhagen and raising, you know, what was then a 2.5-year-old daughter during COVID. So there were a lot of things going on in my life at the time that effectively forced me to seek out spaces for myself and for my daughter at the time. And throughout the years, so I've been doing my PhD since 2020, with COVID, with also 2 pregnancies, it kind of became something that was very much forced on me. I'm not going to lie. It wasn't something that came very natural to me, even though I did choose to make sure that I made space. So what I used to do on a weekly basis, was draw out at least 2 afternoons where I was just reading instead of, you know, frantically writing or trying to apply for conferences or trying to look at what publications I could get part of. And then on a monthly basis, I would send, from the very beginning, I would send agendas of work to my PhD supervisor to give him an overview of what I was doing that made me feel at least, you know, not guilty about taking those spaces of rest and prioritizing my family and ultimately prioritizing myself as well.
Okay, so two things came to my mind while you were talking. The first is, so I guess for you, what really worked, and I would wholly sympathize with this, is being organized.
Exactly.
Setting out a time frame. I think some people come into PhD work a little bit like the crazy professor, you know, as soon as the idea and the work inspires me. And I don't think that's very productive when you're doing
it. No, I think, again, my strength, and I think it's probably yours too, right? It's the fact that we worked before we did our PhDs made us realize that we had to structure our days like a work day, like a proper, you know, work day. And PhD work is also work. But I think the issue is that you can get lost in your thoughts. You can go on forever. It's not something where you can just close a laptop and leave it at the office and then come back to. It's something that you're consistently thinking about, developing ideas, developing arguments, developing your own opinions, your positionalities. And so for me, having from the very beginning, also probably as a consequence of the work I did before the PhD and now after, a very structured approach to what I was doing with goals set for myself where I could self-motivate. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that my PhD started in COVID meant that this was really, really existential. I didn't see anyone for years, effectively. I took an entire master's as part of the PhD program without having gone to a single class in person or met a single one of my fellow colleagues in person. Again, I met them quite regularly online. So I really, really had to structure myself. I really had to organize my day, and I really had to pressure myself into realizing, which I think sometimes also in our culture we don't necessarily do, that this is work, this is my job, and it may not be 9 to 5, but I'm going to try to fit in as much as I can in that 9 to 5 so that I can then go home to my children and be with them and be with my partner.
And I think, as you mentioned, when you're working and doing a PhD, and it's been the case with most of the people I've interviewed for this show, their PhD is about some aspect in some way, shape or form related to their work. So obviously the line gets really blurred.
I think mine so far, I mean, obviously I deal in foreign policy. So that's very wide. And so it's a bit difficult for it not to be related to my work. But I really could, especially when I came into it towards the end now of my PhD, came back into the fray. I didn't really struggle with distinguishing my thoughts, but I did realize just how much sharper I was in my analysis and my ability to problematize situations and my ability to find nuance.
I found
that difficult at first. I'm not going to lie. I did find it difficult to find that balance between scholar Jenny and, you know, diplomat Jenny, but not for very long, to be perfectly honest, because I was able to understand that those were two different work streams. But yes, it does definitely overflow.
Your critical thinking skills become so much better, and they become so, whenever I'm doing anything related to the PhD, and that obviously filters into my work, I have my supervisor in the back of my head going, but why? But why is this important? But to explain it, but so what? She likes to ask me the question, so what? And I've realized, so obviously I have staff and I mentor them and I guide them and everything. And I've realized, especially this past week, that I'm kind of, you know, treating them like they are PhD students in the making, which they're not. And bless their sweethearts, maybe they're looking at me, you know, going, why is she putting us through all these ropes? And it's because I find it difficult to switch.
Sorry, pardon?
I find it difficult to switch.
I don't know. I don't think I do. I think that at the beginning, perhaps the first weeks, what I found quite difficult is the fact that I didn't really have any flexibility. Obviously, being in foreign policy, the work streams are very fast. You know, 1 second something is happening in one place and the next in another, and you have to change your position. And,
of course.
You know, you also have to change your geographical location in your head every, you know, I don't know, 15 seconds sometimes it feels. So I didn't really have any time to, especially at the beginning, kind of returning back to the diplomatic to diplomatic work, that I didn't really find that challenge. But what I do find, what I do find challenging, as I said, is sometimes I have a lot of these kind of very academic lenses on everything that I see and hear and do. Mm-hmm. And that was quite intrusive at the beginning. When you do critical legal research like I've been doing, it really forces you to dig very deep into the so what and the why.
Yes.
Especially, why do you think this way? Is it because of this background? Is it because you have worked here? Is it because you have, I don't know, institutional experience? Is it because you're white? Is it because you're a woman? Is it because you are, you know, of a certain class? And that constantly forces me, perhaps also in my job, and I think to my benefit, to employ a degree of empathy in everything that I do. But obviously sometimes, again, in fast work streams, it can be a little bit overwhelming. I think that is the thing that I noticed, but it wasn't something that I couldn't keep in check. It was just something that I kind of acknowledged and, you know, tapped on the head. And also, I'm very proud to bring that lens into the work that we do, precisely because I feel that that the work that we do requires an enormous degree of empathy at a very difficult moment in time. And I'm really grateful to the PhD for giving me that, very informed way of seeing issues as intersectional, and therefore making my analysis, I believe, sharper. But also, I realized that at the beginning of the year, as well as I rolled into the very final stages, I realized that that was, you know, these lenses, these, why do I think this way? Is this because of this? It really did structure my daily interactions with everyone, even my family. So towards the end, I think the idea of work-life balance, or at least of separation, becomes really murky.
Instead of looking at separation of powers, it's more like the separation of lenses. That's a very legal joke. I don't know if
the audience it's a long will, joke. I appreciate that.
If the audience will fully understand that, but I'm going to throw it out there. So let me focus on a really important word that you mentioned, empathy. I think empathy is absolutely the next word that everybody needs to consider when you're talking about work-life balance. So, for example, in this very, very complex situation that you have already described, was there maybe one particular incident that really highlighted how much empathy is important? You mentioned your supervisors, you mentioned the community, you mentioned your family, your bosses, maybe something that really, really made a difference and really sticks out.
It's difficult to say, because there have been so many moments in the last 5 years that have really just required me to mobilize all my strength sometimes around giving myself space and employing a degree of self-empathy also, which sometimes I think is just really missing in in our culture and in the way we interact, which then obviously leads to us in being incapable of showing empathy towards not just our academic community, but also sometimes our wider society, which makes it even, which perhaps makes it even more explosive. But starting from the, you know, the self, and just realizing that it's okay, you know, telling myself it's okay to walk away from this thought. It's okay to leave it in a file. It's okay that to, I understand that this is important to you, I would say, but you need to, this is a PhD, it's not a manifesto. And I think when I transitioned from, as I said in the beginning, my research started on the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So there was a degree of distance and lack of proximity as I tried to navigate, you know, something that wasn't, I didn't have a history with. Although we as Europeans do, I as a Maltese person was kind of encountering it as a scholar rather than as a lived and personal experience. But when I transitioned into doing work on Malta, I think my ability to separate myself from my work and also to find spaces where I let myself have empathy if I didn't follow through with, you know, thoughts or my opinions, or even just continuing archival research to try and get to the end of it, trying to remind myself that this is a finite amount of time and it's a long life. And if I wanted to pick this up, I would be able to as well. But reminding myself that these are not my problems to solve alone. That is where I found that the situation really overtook, I think, in the last, especially, let's say, 2 years of the PhD, where everything I saw, I felt like I needed to find a solution for it, especially when I got to, you know, opening up personal family archives, deliberations with the political classes in the 1920s and 30s.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Listening and reading to pieces of work, because I also used poetry, despite being a lawyer, to try and inform the ideas around the Maltese constitution, what it meant for people at the time, what the road to independence and the road to our constitution that that was granted to us by the British in 1964 meant to the people. And I found it really difficult when I put myself, especially in the family archives, to separate myself. So it did require an enormous amount of mobilizing empathy for these actors, mm-hmm. you know, in our history, trying to understand why they did it, but also trying and why they didn't do certain things, what went wrong. But then realizing that I'm a very small part in the cog, but still, you know, an intrinsic one, given that this research is also really, really, I don't want to say unique, but certainly not as prevalent as at least I would hope. So that empathy, I think, was really important also as I cultivated my own voice around speaking Maltese constitutional history, but also Maltese history.
You've mentioned so many interesting points. I can't keep up with you in a good way. So I think what really struck me while you were describing your research, first of all, it has. I want to address that small point that you said. Oh, it's not unique. It is unique. It has to be unique. All our supervisors, it has to be unique, Jenny.
I tell myself every day, this is an enormous contribution to the literature, but I do believe it. I do believe it to be. Otherwise, I would not have been able to carry myself through the last, especially 2.5 years. It's important work insofar as it lends a bit of a different set of eyes, but also significantly voice. I think in Maltese research, sometimes what I can't even count how many, you know, papers and, you know, browse through, I don't know how many books. But ultimately what I've found very interesting about the Maltese case specifically and why I chose it is this, the importance of us finding voice collectively. And
of course.
That obviously permeated into everything that I did, because I love my country and I very much want it to be the best it could possibly be. And so I wanted to be able to cultivate our history differently from the perspective of a Maltese woman, not from the perspective of, you know, a Brit or whatever, and turn the gaze inwards, but also open up spaces for the rest of Europe to look at Malta as not just a liminal space that should be disregarded, but a central part of Europe and what Europe is.
Of course. And this is so interesting. And this is, people might be thinking that we're veering off topic, but we're not really, because what you're mentioning, first of all, shows a real sense of the development of mature thoughts that all PhD students go through. And I go back to what I said earlier, that your lines get blurred in the sense that your topic sort of becomes your identity. Now, in your case, there's the added level that you are actually doing a thesis in some way, shape or form, which is about Maltese identity. Mm-hmm. So And what I want to ask is, obviously, when you're first going into a PhD, you know, you're bushy-tailed, you don't know what you're really getting into. People tell you it's a marathon, not a sprint, and you're like, what does that mean? Why are you giving me sports analogies, you know, for a PhD? And as time goes by, you realize that is a perfect analogy.
Yes, it really is. It's true.
And it just becomes this other part of you in the
way it really does. It's another organ now. Mm-hmm.
Another organ. I like that.
I think that there needs to be, and I'm really glad that you're doing this series, because I think there needs to be a lot more awareness of how challenging it is to finish. How challenging it is once you grow this other organ that becomes such an enormous part of your identity, of who you are, to let it go. I think the hardest part of my PhD is the last weeks before I close up shop. And not say goodbye, but certainly just move on, take everything I have learned as if I'm carrying a backpack, or at least 50 backpacks it feels right now, and take it forward in life and in everything that I do. But to close that, to make that final kind of press that submit button, I think is going to be the hardest one, because it does very much become part of your identity. And 100% for me, because I have also always done research on developing Maltese identity, in this case, constitutional identity. So what is it that, you know, constitutes us as a nation legally? It just feels like I have been reconstructing who I am.
I can imagine. I can, hearing you speak, I'm sort of going through the process with you in a very small 30-minute kind of way.
It is really profound. I didn't expect it to be this profound. I think that one of the reasons why I didn't want to do my PhD on Malta was because I was afraid of what that would feel like. And certainly there were many moments where it was, especially going through the family archives. Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was imprisoned by the British, and he wrote while he was in prison, but also afterwards, and seeing the transition he made, I think, intellectually as well. He was an author and a journalist, and a big defender of the Maltese language, which obviously got him into trouble, because at the time, the last thing Britain wanted, at least the colonial Britain, right, wanted, was the augmentation and consolidation of the Maltese nation. And for the people, you know, understood generally to have that voice. And for me to be able to give life to that and to, again, cultivate a space for that voice.
Are you writing a thesis about the work-life balance of your great-grandfather?
He definitely had no work-life balance, this man. I have no idea how he was so productive, but it definitely gave me so much space again to relive and also to reconstruct who we are. And that is something that was very intrinsic to disturbing my work-life balance, let's say that. But at the same time, it gave me, I think, a higher meaning of what life meant to me and what was important to me, you know, as a person, as Jenny, but also as a mother, and what I wanted to see in the future for myself, but also for my ladies, my girls at home.
Of course. On that note, now that we've mentioned the three beautiful ladies at home. So on other episodes, the PhD has been likened to a pregnancy. And I did want to ask you firsthand, is it a fair analogy? Is it a little insensitive? Feel free, be as brutal, honest as you want. I mean, are there similarities? Can you understand? To be fair, the metaphor was not used by men. it was used by a woman.
That's really funny. I've had this analogy. I think yesterday my girlfriends who have carried me through, also scholars, also doing their PhDs and various moments in my own, we talked about having a baby shower for me after I submit. So it's not okay. Definitely not an unfair comparison. I think the difference is that when you're pregnant, apart from carrying a load, once you give birth, it's much more troublesome than perhaps the pregnancies. At least I was very fortunate to have relatively okay pregnancies. Once you give birth, you know, the trouble really starts. So I hope when I submit, trouble won't start, because that will be very problematic and very counterproductive to the PhD. But certainly there are a lot of analogies that can be drawn to the process, because there's so much expectation as well throughout the, especially, I mean, this is my first and only PhD. I'm saying it so that I never go into it again, and you have me on record, Myrna, to enforce this.
I will remind you.
So I will. It's like a first pregnancy. You know, you don't know what's coming. You don't know what it should feel like. What you should do. How you should think. Where you should go. If you're doing something right. But hopefully, it won't be as sleepless once I do hand in and press submit.
If it's any consolation, my PhD is 6 years long because I'm doing it part time. So
yeah, no, but I also look, my PhDs in Denmark are 3 years on average, and mine has been 5 years because I took 2 years of leave, and I also did a master's degree on top of that, right? So it was meant to be four technically. So it's going to be just over 3 years, I think, for me in total of doing the PhD. And I really treasured every moment, even the difficult ones. There were a lot of sleepless nights, not because I was, you know, pressured or into doing anything, but I really took my own productivity very seriously. I take everything very seriously. I've always been like this. And so I really committed, doubled down to the process. So that structure, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that structure was really important to me, because it was the only way I could kind of force myself to find space. But also finding your academic community, that was an enormous part of this process and in everything that I did, especially when I became, you know, mother times three during the process. And when I did my fellowships abroad, which are an intrinsic part of also the PhD fellowship in Copenhagen, I relied on them so much, sometimes to keep me going, to keep me on the right track. Finding my academic community was something just completely invaluable, and that is something that I really want to impart, I think. Going back to your question, that it's just extremely important to really choose yourself through that, especially if you're writing about subjects that are incredibly important to you. All our PhDs are important to us, but some hit home a little bit a little bit too much. Yes. It's important to separate yourself, but it's important also to do something that you believe in. I don't have the magic sauce for what the balance.
Jenny, it's been great discussing this theme with you today. Unfortunately, time is never on our side, as all PhD students know. Thank you so much for joining me today. I think that was another insightful discussion into the unique world of doing a PhD. As we heard today, maintaining work-life balance during a PhD isn't about perfect routines or rigid boundaries. It's about learning to listen to yourself, adjusting along the way, and finding your own version of what balance means. If you're currently on the PhD journey and feeling overwhelmed, please know that you are not alone.
Nope.
Thank you to Marka Juice for the technical assistance. I'm Myrna Topardi-Wood, and I'll be back with you next week for PhD Unpacked on Campus 103.7.